Okay, good afternoon. I'm going to call to order this meeting of the Senate Committee on Environment and Natural Resources. It is Monday, the 22nd of May, and we have four bills up for public hearings. We will not be working any of these bills because
today.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Senator. So that we can give people time to think about them. But we will have the public hearings. Before we get started, let me say that we have House Bill 2099, the fish persistence bill, is up for a hearing on Wednesday, but we're not actually going to hear it on Wednesday. So for those of you following that issue, if you want to schedule your calendars, we have a work group going. We seem to be close to something, so we're going to put it off till next week. Okay, so I'm going to start off with House Bill 2711. We have a couple of esteemed colleagues who are going to speak to it. And so, Reps Hellman Lively, if you would come up, and while you're doing that, Beth, could you tell us what this bill does?
Mr. Chair, members, House Bill 2711A would impose a statewide moratorium on hydraulic fracturing until 2027.
Thank you. Rep Lively.
Thank you. Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Lively. I'm state representative from House District 12, which is the city of Springfield. I'm here today to speak to you about House Bill 2711. My involvement in this bill goes back to, well, the last session, but more this session, this past last summer before this session, when some constituents in my district came to me concerned about fracking, what might or might not happen in the state of Oregon, and what the state may be going to do about that. In addition, at the same time I had those conversations, I had conversations with the Department of Geology to understand a little bit better the geology in the state and where, if indeed, there might be the types of deposits that might be something that would be explored and could be subject to fracking. And it turned out those are in the valley versus someplace else in the state. Doesn't separate the fact that there are someplace else in the state might not be an issue, but in the valley where there's so much population. So having had those conversations, came back, I thought, to me it was important to call just a time out and say, let's take a longer look at this and see. There may not be any immediate, or there may be, but obviously opinions greatly at this point differ on this technique and what the outcomes may or may not be. For me, one of the important considerations now, though, in asking for this moratorium is the fact that the valley is where we're mostly talking about, the valley where we already have evidence and close to the fault zone, and if there is major earthquakes or even minor earthquakes, in many cases we're subject to those, and the question about whether fracking leads to those or not, in some cases I think we know that it does. It enhances that. In some cases it does not. Another reason from my standpoint to take some time to look at that. The second thing, risk from my standpoint, is well water. So the majority of human consumption water in the state of Oregon comes from wells, and very much of the water in the valley comes from wells. So I live in a community, all of our water comes from wells, but many of the other communities in the valley, along with the agriculture, and that comes from wells. And so from my standpoint, there's still some risk, even though we've learned a lot from fracking, there's a risk to those wells and contamination of those wells, something we need to know more about. And the third thing that motivated me from this particular time is some of the changes that may or may not occur. They're occurring at the national level. And the emphasis on exploration in the United States for more oil reserves than what it's been in the past. And all of those things combined just said to me, this might be a good time for us in the state of Oregon to take more time. The 10-year moratorium seemed to make sense. Obviously, a lot can happen in 10 years. We can be back in session multiple times in 10 years, so who knows what that might lead to. But I just felt strongly, and that's why I agreed to support and push this bill for a moratorium on fracking. Thank you.
Thanks, Representative.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Dembro, members of the committee. My name is Tana Sanchez. I'm the representative for House District 43, North and Northeast Portland. And, of course, I'm sure you heard a lot of details already, so I won't go into some of those different pieces. But I am coming to this issue, of course, from a very maybe personal historical, you know, place of being an environmentalist for many, many years for working on indigenous populations, just those violations of human rights when it comes to digging in the ground and leaving people environmentally vulnerable in terms of uranium and coal mining and all those different types of things. So when this issue, when I heard about this issue and the, in my opinion, need for House Bill, this House Bill, I thought, well, of course, it makes sense because where's the fracking going to be? If we can do it at all, it's going to be in the valley where we have a lot of populations, of course, depending on that water there. You heard Representative Lively talk about that. The possibility of underground contamination of those waters, that's really a frightening thing. But let me also just tell you, I have extended family in Oklahoma where they have extensive fracking going on, and where those family members and community members talk about small earthquakes and larger earthquakes and earthquakes that they've never experienced before happening on a regular basis now, and how amazingly frightening that is, because they actually talk about it on the news as being related to the fracking. That really makes me nervous, given our capacity to have that happen here as well, given our you know, the Cascadia issue. And in particular, when I first came to the legislature, I had a conversation with folks from our emergency management group, and I asked them, so what does it look like for preparedness if we have the big earthquake? And I can't remember the gentleman's name, but he started launching into, well, it'll be, you know, the bridges and this much in that time, you know, will take 50 years to get us to a place where we're environmentally, you know, where our system is ready for this. And I said, no. I'm talking what happens if the earthquake hits tomorrow. And are you prepared to support communities tomorrow? He said, no. You and your family need to be prepared for a minimum of 2 weeks to take care of it yourself. Now, I don't know about you, but that's pretty darn scary in my opinion. A minimum of 2 weeks that we would have to deal with it all by ourselves because we don't have a system ready to deal with something like that. I don't think that this is a thing that we can just take a chance on, personally. I think we are overdue, as I understand from science, we are somewhat overdue for the earthquake here in this area. I think if we do something that will possibly impact that or make that an even greater possibility, I don't think that's the best use of our capacities as a legislature, as a state, to do something that could possibly hurt us even further. So I just think that the lives and the community and the well-being of our water and land and the safety of the valley is far more important than making a few bucks here and there. Thanks.
Thank you, Representative. Senator Helm.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Ken Helm, State Representative for House District 34. This bill is an iteration of a bill that I brought in 2015, and it's returned to its original form. During that session, having some comments from my committee members on the Energy and Environment Committee on the House side, they suggested, hey, you know, are there ways that we can adapt our existing administrating rules to make this industry safer here in Oregon if and when it comes? And so I went down that route and talked to the department and looked at their rules. They have some they have some relatively recent rules on conventional drilling. They do not have rules for hydraulic fracking is considered unconventional for a number of reasons, and in part because you need different controls on the wellhead and different controls on what goes down the well and what comes back up. What we did in 2015 was send a bill down to Ways and Means saying, let's pay for some rulemaking around this. It had a steep price tag and did not make it through the Ways and Means process. So now we're back doing it the cheap way, which is to say, let's push the pause button on this technology until we learn more. Other parts of the country have adopted regulations that have solved many of the problems associated with fracking. Pennsylvania is one of those. And I think we have three graduates of the Lehigh program here, right? Myself, Senator Roblin, Senator Dembro, and I think Senator Olson. And so we've that's the Legislative Energy Horizons Institute. It's a two-week program in which they usually have a program about fracking and what has occurred in other parts of the country. Pennsylvania has done quite a good job. They've amassed a good track record now that they've cleaned up their act and adopted some very rigorous regulations. We just don't have that here in the state. So if this industry comes knocking, we'll be caught flat-footed trying to cobble together regulations from a couple of different agencies to attempt to make this practice safer for the groundwater and safer for people. Until we get the capacity to look at rules of our own, I wanted to follow the precautionary principle and just hit the pause button. So today we found some additional information that I asked Beth to post on OLIS. It is information from the National Caucus of Environmental Legislators that explain the other states. There are about a dozen of them that have either banned fracking or have regulations, and then some other information from NCEL about the risks of fracking. So that's what we have for you.
Great, thank you. Colleagues, any questions of this panel? Yes, just Senator Bercher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do we have any fracking or any proposed fracking going on in Oregon right now?
Senator and Mr. Chair, in my understanding, no. Senator Roblin in his district has a project that has been, for the time being, mothballed, where some wells were sunk, exploratory wells, seeking coal bed methane. And in talking with him, it was very interesting for me to learn the collaboration that went on between the promoter of those wells, Dagami, and I think DEQ, to try and study what they were doing right then and there to make sure that it was going to be done in a safe manner. The senator was satisfied that that had occurred. As I understand it, at the moment, those wells are capped off. It became, for one reason or another, not economically feasible for them. Nevertheless, in this bill, we've carved out those specific wells through language so that they've already done something, they've already put money in the ground, that the moratorium would not apply to those wells. Other than that, I'm unaware of any.
Follow-up?
Yes.
Were those wells being fracked?
Were they being hydraulically fracked? I do not believe so.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Okay, thank you all for bringing this.
Thank you.
We have a number of people to hear from on different sides of the issue. What I'd like to do next is, on the phone, we have Alex Crocus, who is Senator Frederick's legislative assistant or intern, and he's been doing a lot of work in this area, but he's out of town at a conference, so he's called in. Alex, are you there?
Yes. Thank you, Senator Dembro.
Yeah. Okay, Alex, go ahead and tell us what you want to tell us.
Okay. Thank you, all of you, for listening to my testimony. Condensed it down to just 4 minutes. I would like to be there actually to show some of the images, so perhaps at some point I could show a couple images off of my testimony supplement, if possible. Mm-hmm. But I'll just start off. So the quantity of unconventional hydraulic fracturing campaigns.
Alex, I'm sorry. Before you begin, give us your name for the record.
Oh, my name is Alexander Crocus, and I assist District 22. As a researcher, specifically pertaining to environmental and economic policy.
Okay, great. Go ahead, Alex.
Okay. The quantity of unconventional hydraulic fracturing campaigns has increased immensely, predominantly in the U.S. over the past decade. Regulations which administer unconventional horizontal gas drilling fail to adequately adequately protect against the potential negative environmental consequences, such as the vast polluting and contamination of below ground aquifers, lakes, streams, diminished air quality, and the recent increased frequency and intensity of seismic activity. Unconventional hydraulic fracturing is predominantly conducted in unknown geological conditions due to the mass drilling of directional horizontal wellbores. Conventional wellbores are placed on average approximately 6,000 feet in the permeable rock formations. Unconventional horizontal wellbores can be drilled in excess of 13,000 feet below the Earth's surface, and then extending over 10,000 feet horizontally, crossing into highly impermeable rock deep into uncharted geological territory. 95% of new wells drilled today are hydraulically fractured. Regulatory policies which protect human and our ecosystems from the unconventional natural gas extraction process are solely administered by individual state authorities who conduct all oversight and implementation plans. The U.S. federal government has carelessly granted this power over the states, which has enabled the natural gas industry to create their own standard procedures for competitive waste disposal. The Energy Policy Act of 2005 limited the EPA's ability to regulate invasive sediment runoff from fracturing sites and also allowed the industry a categorical exclusion from the National Environmental Policy Act, the Clean Water Act, and the Safe Water Drinking Act. Unit unconventional hydraulic fracturing requires directional horizontal drill. The possibility of illegally invading nearby landowners' property without their consent is considered a common occurrence. According to EPA, chemicals used in the fracturing process usually only comprise a small percentage of the solution, approximately 2%. If you consider that each individual hydraulically fractured well requires an average of over 5 million gallons of water per injection, which is approximately 30 times higher than in the year 2000, that 2% is equivalent to over 10,000 gallons of chemicals at the low end of the spectrum, with the ability to produce an astounding 316 gallons of chemicals per well for each fracturing session, which can transpire multiple times annually for decades. Hydraulic fracturing wells located in the U.S. inject an astounding 250 billion gallons of water, along with 5 billion gallons of toxic chemicals into hydraulically fractured wellbores between the years of 2005 and 2012. An analysis conducted by the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation confirmed that contaminated flowback released from fracturing wells is comprised of hazardous materials such as arsenic, barium, cadmium, chromium, cobalt, copper, iron, hydrochloric acid, lead, nickel, silver, titanium, and many others. Credible quantitative scientific studies have discovered in excess of 632 various hazardous pollutants comprised in the hydraulic fracturing water solution. Concerns associated with seismic activity are directly related to the vital disposal of fracturing wastewater. During the time period from 1973 to 2008, an average of 21 earthquakes of magnitude 3 or larger occurred in central and eastern United States. In 2014, that value increased to over 600. 1 year later, that number rose to more than 1,000, 48 times the 50-year average. Geological faults have a natural ability to sustain high stress without slipping because of natural tectonic stress. The violent injection of contaminated fracturing solution counteracts the frictional forces of the fault and pries them apart, causing human-made induced seismic activity to occur. So now I just want to move to my supplement, and if we could just... I don't know if anybody can do it. There's just a couple images. If you can only do one, I would just say page 11. It's just a simple picture, but I'll just continue just because I know your time is limited. But the increased frequency of injection-induced earthquakes was initially observed in 2009 by the scientific community. The potential ability for wastewater injection to cause human-induced seismic activity has been common knowledge and universally accepted by the U.S. and international geologists and geophysicists since the mid-1960s. Until 2011, the most intense injection-induced seismic activity occurred during the Rocky Mountain Arsenal earthquake, which transpired in 1967. In 2011, after the vast rise of unconventional directional and horizontal hydraulic fracturing, substantial intended seismic activity was recorded in Prague, Oklahoma, Trinidad, Colorado, Simpson, Texas, and Guy, Arkansas. Surprisingly, in all these site-specific regions, fracturing fluid injection wells were located in extreme close proximity to the seismic activity, and the USGS also confirmed the valid connection between the actual timing of the immense fluid injection procedure and the unnatural human-induced earthquakes. Now, during another study conducted by the U.S. in 2016, researchers researched 19 different regions where human-made injection-induced earthquakes transpired, and geophysicists were actually able to successfully predict the future frequency of human seismic activity. That's a formula they used around page 2 of the supplement. But all these 19 sites passed all their statistical tests and revealed that the fluid injection ejection process controlled earthquake nucleation, but tectonics controlled the earthquake magnitude, and the actual injected volume of fracturing fluids controlled the total number of earthquakes. Earthquakes historically have not been associated within the scope of civil litigation until recently. Essentially, seismic activity has been directly related to acts of God or as unforeseen and unpredictable catastrophic events. Currently, there's a plethora of litigation transpiring solely linked to induced human aid earthquakes. The Oklahoma Geological Survey has concluded that the recent vast rise in seismic activity experienced in your state was very unlikely to represent a naturally occurring process. I'm on page 6, this will show all the wells that they shut down from the Oklahoma Corporations Commission. But on March 7th, 2016, the Oklahoma Corporations Commission required fracturing well operators located in central Oklahoma to reduce by 40% the amount of oil and gas waste being ejected into over 400 wells. This followed another OCC implemented measure that happened just 1 month earlier in northwest Oklahoma, which also demanded that over 400 ejection wells significantly reduce the fracturing wastewater disposal. And there's a graph on page 7 of the supplement from the Oklahoma Corporations Commission and the Oklahoma Geological Survey showing the connection between the water volume going down and the decrease in seismic activity. And then I just wanted to say a little bit about the litigation. I'm just doing a brief of a brief, but I just want to end up going to in Pawnee Nation of Oklahoma, the Eagle Road Oil LLC. It was due to an earthquake that transpired that was 5.8 magnitude on September 3rd of 2016, which was a state record. This induced seismic activity severely damaged the majority of Pawnee Nation of Oklahoma's administrative buildings. It also caused extensive structural damage to numerous personal residents and to multiple other buildings. The damage sustained was a result of 53 earthquakes that transpired between September and November of 2016. And there was a quote that I researched a lot of this case and just looked into a lot of the documents, and it was from the president of the Pawnee Nation of Oklahoma, and it's a big quote. It's essentially what we're talking about right now, and it says that it bothers us that the Pawnee Nation has asked for a moratorium on the fracturing process conducted on our lands and have largely been ignored. We have stated that we aren't against oil and gas production. We are certainly against methods which hurt our land-based minerals and water. The earthquakes are a great motivator for us to move and protect our land, resources, and people. And just if you could put on page 11 of the supplement, and I just kind of show you with the Cascadia subduction zone and USGS seismic activity hazard map, natural induced. And unconventional hydraulic fracturing is an illogical and impractical approach requiring energy independence. So it is exceptionally imperative for rapid regulatory change to transpire now so that we can ensure human security to all future generations of Oregonians, perhaps Californians, and Canadians if we do start man-induced, injection-induced seismic activity in the Cascadia subduction zone. And so I just, earlier in the session, I know that Senator Dembro, I gave you a copy, and Senator Roblin, and it was a draft of a bill talking about banning all unconventional directional and horizontal hydraulic fracturing, and setting specific limitations on conventional drilling to 6,000 feet vertical with 177,000 gallons of water per fracture, which is a 2,000 rate. And I'm currently waiting back from Dr. Paul Warner. He's doing me a favor. He's doing a fiscal on it. So I was just hoping that you guys, I heard earlier, are not going to move this to a work session, and I was thinking of a possible amendment to make it more, passable, essentially.
Okay, well, thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, no, thank you for Alex, and thank you for all the work you've been doing on this project. And so just kind of in a nutshell, your recommendation is that, we look at that we go forward with the moratorium, that we go look at tightening up the rules around the methodology behind hydraulic fracturing.
Exactly. Yeah, because we've been doing it for such a long time, and it's just, once you go, if you go 6,000 feet vertically, there hasn't been as much leakage or contamination, and you really don't really see any seismic activity occurring. All this activity is because of these unconventional methods. When they're going 10,000 feet down, 12,000 feet over, and all this produced wastewater, they pump them into Class 2 injection wells. And in some parts of the country, up to 100% of it, that's like on the back page of my original testimony, it's like from an EPA study at the end of last year, and almost 100% of that toxic water back up, and they have to pump them into these wells. And that's essentially what's happening. I mean, it's just almost common sense when you think about water volume being injected to the earth and the weight and the intensity. And the thing is, because there is no federal regulation, and because the 2005 Energy Policy Act happened as a way to explore for natural gas because of to gain energy independence, and we are gaining more energy independence because of hydraulic fracturing, but the ecological damage is just, it's not really worth it. I mean, if you want to think of it in a logical sense. But I think that it can be done, but I do support Representative Helms' bill 100%. But I think there could be a possible amendment. I was talking with my office before I left to come down here to Sacramento, and I was just to get unconventional directional and horizontal, an outright ban on that. And I don't see how, I mean, there's been over at least a dozen studies from the USGS in the past couple of years. I mean, and they're predicting this induced seismic activity with almost 95% confidence. And so you just have all these experts, and they really focused in on Oklahoma, which is great because it's given the data just to show that this is no joke.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you very much, Alex. Colleagues, you have any questions? Okay, well, Alex, good luck with the rest of your conference down there.
Thank you.
See you when you get back up here.
Okay, I'll see you later this week.
Great. Okay. Bye-bye. Okay, why don't we hear from Brian Doherty and John Mullis next?
Good afternoon, Chair Denbrough, members of the committee. Brian Doherty here today representing the Western States Petroleum Association. I first want to say that while hydraulic fracturing has been going on for over 65 years and it's been done very safely, we do support good regulatory practices in this area and also best practices in the industry, which I think has been going on. And I'll get to some of the statements made earlier. It is a fundamentally safe technology, and if you look at page 3 of my testimony, there's a Dogami fact sheet on hydraulic fracturing in Oregon. And yes, they did a lot in the 2004 to 2006 period when there was some well drilling down in Coos Bay. But any well that goes through the water supply has to have this safe mechanism to do it. It doesn't have to be hydraulic fracturing. They will tell you they treat anything that's piercing through the water table in the same fashion. It's very effectively regulated in Oregon. That company that drilled in Coos Bay was had both the Department of Geology and Mineral Industry, the Department of Environmental Quality, the Water Resources Department, and the EPA were all involved in this. There is, as I said, the regulations in place to ensure water supply is protected. We have, I don't know how to reconcile the numbers we have for the amount of water used in hydraulic fracturing, which we find it's average of 116,000 gallons, and the average household uses 146,000 gallons a year. Now, it sounds like maybe in Oklahoma they've reduced water supply, but what I understand from our readings in Oklahoma is that it was not the hydraulic fracturing that caused the problem, but it was the reinjection of the water into an aquifer below the aquifer it was taken out of, the Arbuckle Formation. And for some reason, I don't know why, because most other places you put it back into, it's cleaner than the water they brought out, but it's you put it back into the same formation. Take a look at California. It has a lot of earthquake-prone nature to it, and you haven't associated any hydraulic fracturing and earthquakes in California, and they have a number going on. Finally, I just want to give you a couple of quotes that are in my testimony. Two EPA administrators under Obama, Lisa Jackson and Gina McCarthy, both conducted extensive studies. And Lisa Jackson's quote from May of 2011, "In no case have we made a definitive determination that fracking processes cause chemicals to enter groundwater." Gina McCarthy, November 4th, 2013, "There's nothing inherently dangerous in fracking that sound engineering practices can't accomplish." Finally, Sally Jewell, Secretary of the U.S. Department of Interior under President Obama. I'm not aware of any proven case where the fracking process itself has affected water quality. So with that, I will be glad to answer any questions, but I believe that this is a process that with proper regulation can be done right. I know of no hydraulic fracturing going on in Oregon, nor any plans, certainly not from our companies, going on in Oregon. Thank you very much.
Thank you. John?
Hi, good afternoon, Chair Dembrough, members of the committee. My name is John Molis. I'm here this afternoon to testify in opposition to House Bill 2711 on behalf of Cascade Natural Gas. Cascade Natural Gas supplies natural gas to communities in central and eastern Oregon. Domestic energy production is making it possible for the United States to become energy independent and, in fact, probably an energy exporter, and we think that's a good thing. Energy production and transportation are creating thousands of good-paying jobs right here in the United States. And finally, Cascade Natural Gas supports the Jordan Cove Energy Project, and that project is made possible in part by domestic energy production. The Jordan Cove Energy Project could create a huge economic boost in an area of Oregon that's been struggling to economically recover for 25 years. That's what I have for this afternoon. I thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. Thank you, both of you. So let me ask you a question. There are no current plans to do unconventional fracking, hydraulic fracturing here in the state. So what would be the downside to the moratorium? Or is there, one of the things we heard from the proponents was let's hit the pause button while rules are being refined in other states. Is a moratorium a problem for now since there are no plans underway to actually access the resource here? Yes, Brian.
Chair Dembrough, thank you. My feeling is you're saying if we don't have a problem now, why don't we pass legislation? I don't think that's the right way to look at this. If you have some problem and you have agencies you think cannot handle this, that's fine. Does this mean banning, allowing other type of drilling through groundwater that cause it? I think the fundamental issue is hydraulic fracturing causing damage that other well drilling is not? And I don't think we're seeing that, at least from the EPA administrators that have studied it and others.
And Chair Dembrough, if I may.
Yes, John.
Just the rapid change of technology and how rapidly things can change in energy production and so many other things in this world, 10 years just seems like an awful long time. I would think that rules could be written sooner than that.
Colleagues, any questions?
Yes.
Yes, Senator Brzozinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Brian, we had a chance to talk, and thank you for dropping off the material that's posted here. But taking the testimony that you've given and the proponents for the bill, what state can we turn to right now and say they've got it? Is Pennsylvania the state that has the rules that seem to address this? That's kind of what I'm finding myself trying to figure out. What, if anything, do we have to use as a roadmap for setting our rules? How much time, as John says, is it going to really take for us to actually do this? And if we're going to have a timeout, what's a reasonable length of time to allow for this to be addressed before we have someone coming in, before the rules are done, and then we find ourselves trying to, regulate where we have no regulations, or very few, I should say, not none.
Chair Dembrough, Senator Brzozinski, I don't know to tell you that here's the best state practice or the best regulatory practice. I know that we support those sound regulatory practices that do that and best techniques. I'd be happy to try and get you an opinion from our folks. Again, we work in the five Western states, so that's the territory of Western States
Patrol. Have to get the cousins over in more central part of the state.
We certainly do have. And the eastern part and lots of other parts.
Eastern too, definitely.
Great, thank you. I mean, one of the things that gives me concern, I will say in all candor, is I'm concerned about what's coming out of the EPA right now in Washington, D.C. There was just an article in the New York Times this weekend about the EPA, who's, you know, the director of the EPA, of course, was the Attorney General in Oklahoma has very strong feelings about this practice. And just to quote for you, interior officials have also announced their intention to repeal or revise a contentious rule requiring companies like Devon, which is a gas exploration firm, to take extra steps to prevent groundwater contamination caused by hydraulic fracturing, also known as fracking. And that would concern me, right, that the federal government is you know, interested in relaxing the rules around, around groundwater contamination. So I think, you know, we as a state will need to at least assess, so what are our rules that can, you know, in the absence of strong federal rules, right? So, I mean, it sounds like that's something that, you know, you would be, that you agree with, Brian, you know, that is that we need to look at our rules and make sure that they're doing the protection that we know we need.
Chair Denbrough, I agree. We'd be happy to participate in that. Sounds like we have time. I don't think we have something going now. And I know that the conventional drilling that's going on in Idaho that may be looking at something in eastern Oregon, none of that is requiring hydraulic fracturing. That is wells, but I don't see that hydraulic fracturing is on the horizon.
Great. Okay, thank you.
Thank you
both. In a moment, I'm going to ask Ian from Dogami to come up. But before we do that, we have another legislator here. I want to we have a topic I think we can address pretty quickly. So I'm going to suspend for now our public hearing on 2711, and I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3006. And Representative Hayden, you want to come up? And Doug, did you want to come up too?
Get the summary.
Oh, yeah, Beth, you want to tell us what this is?
Mr. Chair, members, House Bill 3006A would require the Department of Forestry to establish a list of Oregon-based contractors that are qualified to supply the Department of Wildfire Suppression Equipment in time for a fire season that begins on or after January 1, 2018.
Welcome, Representative.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Cedric Hayden, State Representative, House District 7. To start with, I want to list a potential conflict of interest. I am a provider, a contractor that provides services for the federal government in terms of fire suppression, both ground and aerial services. This bill was brought to me by Cliff Bentz from some of his constituents that were concerned with the availability of being able to check whether they had been qualified to be on a list of approved firefighters for fire suppression during the summer. There is a state agency that does that for us and does that very well for us in about 12 different districts, and then there is a federal agency that does that through the U.S. Forest Service, and they have a system called VIPER. VIPER is an area that contractors like myself enter their names into, and then there's a public website that we can go in and verify what our status is. Is our status opened? Are we only local in the state of Oregon? Are we in a geographical northwest area? Are we national available? And so the intent of this bill is to kind of mimic, but to keep separate from the federal government, so the state has the flexibility to call to fires appropriate contractors that they want, but to disclose that list. And I believe we have come to a consensus agreement on that with the folks that are advocating for it and with the Department of Forestry. Thank you.
And Doug, give us the details.
Good afternoon, Chair Denbrough, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Doug Graff. I serve as Chief Fire Protection, Oregon Department of Forestry. You have my testimony before you, and I'd like to highlight a few comments there. Chiefly available here today for any questions. As the first time this bill is on the Senate side, I did provide testimony on the House side, but that was before the amendments, so wanted to update that testimony and be available for questions. As the bill directly speaks to the department, it specifically highlights wildfire suppression equipment. I wanted to recognize what that means and then how we would implement what the bill directs us to do. So wildfire suppression equipment speaks to equipment utilized in direct suppression tactics. So this would be dozers, engines, water tenders, aviation assets like air tankers and helicopters that drop water and fire retardant on the fire specifically. So I think that's the first key message that I wanted to detail today. In my testimony, I highlight the four areas in which we track those resources currently, effectively the dispatch tools that we utilize. ODF creates a call when needed aviation list. It's about 75 companies that will call when needed as fire conditions increase and we need those resources. We have daily availability contracts from 60 to 75 day contracts for aviation assets. We have about 20 of those contracts available. Each of the 12 protection districts across the state in which we protect 16 million acres of private and public forest land across the state produces a mobilization plan, and that identifies local contractors who will be available for that district. And the fourth place in which we track resources of that nature, the suppression equipment, as Representative Hayden detailed, is the U.S. Forest Service VIPER agreement, the virtual incident procurement. And there's over 100 companies that are nationally available. And we pull from all these resources when the fire bell goes on to procure resources for initial attack and extended attack in Oregon. So ultimately, the department would collect the Oregon-based contractors from all those lists, those dispatch tools, and make that publicly available on a website as I read the rule, and that's what it intends to do based on our interpretation. The second key piece I'd like to highlight is that the bill would not change how we dispatch resources to fires. The fire really dictates, and the incident commander on the scene and the situation of the day and the fire condition dictates how we dispatch and where we pull the resources. And generally, it's closest resources available. Often, the landowners we protect have resources available, and we work closely with emergency response with our forest landowners that we provide protection for, and that's often the first call to deliver resources. So it does not impact the way that we operate in terms of our success at initial attack, keeping fires small, minimizing cost, and minimizing resource loss. The bill also doesn't speak to other support contracts that we utilize, such as kitchens, showers, communication, information technologies that we use when we deploy large incident management teams to support fire conditions across the landscape. With that, I'm available for any questions.
Colleagues, Senator Patrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hayden, you said you had VIPER contracts. Do you supply any resources to Oregon Department of Forestry?
We are, yes, sir. I have a small company called Statewide Contract Services that has both an aviation department and a ground suppression department. We are signed up through VIPER, and those are call when needed available contracts. And I do have aviation contracts available directly through the state, and we provide Department of Fish and Wildlife with wildlife tracking flights.
Mr. Graff, what are you going to limit your calls to whatever resources that you made available on the website? Are you going to limit it to those?
Senator Berchiga, Chair Dembro, no. At the time This will be a stagnant list at the beginning of the season that will pull from those four dispatch tools, and we'll pull out the Oregon-based contractors for suppression equipment and make that list available publicly. As we all recognize, 2013-14 fire seasons, as the condition change, a lot of contractors move into Oregon as we mobilize resources nationally and internationally to support fires in Oregon. And ultimately, we'll be using the practice we always have, which is to procure the resources that can best meet the need of the fires to keep that fire small, minimize costs and loss to the resources.
Follow up. The Federal Viper contract is the best value contract. In other words, it's whoever, they match up similar resources, and whichever one is cheaper gets called first. And it's kind of a running, you start at the top and you start moving down the list. Is your program going to mimic that?
Senator Bertschinger, Chair Dembro. No plans to mimic the Viper agreement in that fashion. This simply would direct us to create the list and post that available so contractors can see the groups of dispatch tools that we have to deploy to fires. We will not change our processes as it's highly effective by mobilizing the closest resources available at that time, and that changes daily. As the fire dictates and resource deployments occur moment to moment throughout fire season. And it's really organized at the local dispatch level, needing to maintain that flexibility of the incident commander on the ground and the local dispatcher on what resources we need, and then what's the best resource to meet that need locally.
One more follow-up.
Yeah, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm just scratching my head trying to figure out what we're trying to fix.
Mm. You stole my question, Senator.
That's
yes.
Our question.
Representative.
Thank you again, Senator Caden, State Representative, House District 7. Thank you for the opportunity. In my opinion, being brought into this because of my knowledge and background in it, is what from the advocates and from the contractor's perspective is all we want to do is see the list and be able to, we're there and we're available. We have no intent, or I have no intent or anyone to change any of the processes or who they call, any of the local or the nearest provider available to. We need to get that to them as immediately as possible. We don't want to change any of that. We would just like the contract list made available to the public. That's the only change I see here.
And so is it also to make sure that you're on the list?
That's correct.
And then if you don't get a call, it's not because of some negligence that
right.
Nobody knew you were there.
Yeah, it's just a way for contractors to verify that we're actually there. The contractors that brought this, again, through Cliff Bentz, and then he asked me to get involved because I'm knowledgeable about it. There's a feeling that there's not a feedback loop. They do a fantastic job. I don't have any concern with that at all. We would just like to be able to have a feedback loop of whether to verify where they're on the list. On the Viper system, it's simply going on the computer and checking.
Okay. And Doug, from the department's perspective, is there a downside to this?
Chair Dembro, in the fiscal produce, there's an administrative task to pull from these various dispatch tools. So there's a workload at the beginning of the season. The downside, perhaps, I want to achieve the goal of the contractors for transparency and understanding how we operate. And the potential is, does this bill not get us there? Certainly, conversations with contractors are important to understand the rules of engagement, the mechanics of when and how and where we deploy fire suppression equipment. In that conversation, working closely with National Wildfire Suppression Association on that topic, this very topic, lots of questions about what are those rules of engagement. We've seen more national contractors engaging locally with the department given the intensities of our fire seasons over the past several years. So I think this is raising recognition and awareness that department works closely with local Oregon contractors who participate nationally and participate with us at the local level and bring in transparency in those processes. So my only concern would be that perhaps this doesn't get us to that end state. And know for the committee that I'll continue to do that with our contractors. It's in our best interest, obviously, and I will leave a message that we have a tremendous asset in the state of Oregon. When I look at where contractors, fire suppression contractors come from across the nation, a good portion of them do come from Oregon, and we're very fortunate to have that partnership relationship, so we want to ensure that's solid.
Yes, Senator.
So, Senator Berkshire kind of asked the question I was going to ask, but I'm looking at this list, Doug, on your letter, the fourth one being the U.S. Forest Service, understanding that more than likely is a secondary source based on what you have as the first three being department-wide. I mean, I'm just trying to figure out the reason we need legislation to do what it sounds like is already available or should be available. And you got these lists. Those lists aren't secret to anyone. If there's a public records request, that's going to come out. So isn't there a way that you could either have something go out in hard copy or something that could be put onto a web page that just says, on this date, this is what we have for ADF aviation, ADF wind call needed agreements, and then breaking them out like that? I'm just trying to figure out why we need to put something in statute to have the department do this if we're all together about wanting all this to be there.
Yeah. Senator Brzezinski, Senator Dembro, that's exactly why I put those bullets on there, so you could see how I would implement and execute the bill.
Doug, right now, if I wanted to know who you had in any of these three columns or even the fourth one, is there some way that I can make that inquiry and find something online right now that you'd have a list that says these are the people we potentially could call for a call when needed agreement versus a daily availability contract? I understand they change within less than 24 hours, but it sounds like what we want to know is at the beginning, pre-fire season, we have 50 contractors that have put themselves out there, or you've recognized that they meet the criteria that we need for them to actually engage in activity here in the state.
Senator Brzezinski, yes, that would be a phone call to the local district dispatch center, to the local fire protection district, and ask for the mobilization plan and make yourself available on that mobilization plan. The mobilization plan is a list of fire suppression resources, support resources, all the landowners within the district that we serve, and sits on the mobilization, the dispatch desk. So when we do get the fire, we have that communication tool. So it would take coordination at the local district for a contractor to say, I'd like to be part of the mobilization plan, and if I'm available as needed, I would be, here's my contact information to coordinate.
Yes, Senator Bertrager, and then we should probably wrap up.
This is my concern. I mean, the bill doesn't mean much to me. I'm sorry, Representative. And for the committee, my first fire was with Oregon Department of Forestry in 1977. The one thing I have some a little concern, Mr. Graff, is that a lot of times when we have a fire breakout, we do on-site hiring. And those people that you do the on-site hiring may not be on your list. So, and when we do on-site hiring, are the people that are on the list going to have a problem with that? So on-site hiring is if a fire breaks out and say there's a logging operation right next door, the department has the ability to just grab those people, that equipment, and do initial attack. Because the faster you get to a fire, the faster you're going to keep it under 10 acres. So is there going to be a conflict now with the people that are on this, quote, list?
Senator Bertrager, Chair Dembro, so the point you're speaking to is emergency equipment rental agreements. We've had that as a tool at the local level. That's how we would typically contract with a local contractor who's closest to the fire. Often, forest operations will pull in contractors from all over the state, and we don't track who's available for fire. We have that stagnant list, so that's why we call the landowner to say, who do you have available, what resources we need, and what we can get. That I don't necessarily could speculate on that risk. It definitely raised a question for me if we do have that list, and that's why I wanted to be here today to speak specifically on how we would implement it and that it doesn't change our rules of engagement if this were to move through and pass. But that could possibly be a concern. That's why I wanted to be clear around how we interpret it and how we would implement this law if it were passed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes. Sorry. So, Doug, I just want to get back, because what I heard you say is at this point, if I wanted to find out who's on a list, I'd have to call into one of the regions. So, like the Douglas Forest Protection Association, who I'm familiar with, gone through that. If I wanted to know who was potentially active or available on their list, I'd have to call their call them to get their particular list as compared to such as Coos Forest Protection Association to see who they have in theirs?
Correct. Senator Prezansky. Okay.
Now I'm starting to get some clarity.
Senator Dembro. So each of the 12 districts produce a mobilization plan, work through their local contractors and local landowners so they know who to call. We are working across districts as a routine basis. Right. If one district has a fire, they call the next district and say, what do you have available? So it may not be necessary for each contractor to contact all 12 districts, and that's we want to gain efficiencies in that process. That's what we want to avoid. In my conversations with Senator Hayden, that's one of the issues that Representative Hayden, my apologies.
I'll take that motion.
That the representative wanted to avoid, and we do that, and we do work across those boundaries very cleanly, and it's the dispatch centers to dispatch centers, and you expand that circle of closest resources. So that was one of the reconciliations that the representative, as I understood, was trying to make clear with, here's the full list, so they don't have to call each of the districts.
Comment?
Yes.
Again, Cedric Hayden, State Representative. So, again, very supportive of Oregon Department of Forestry. Aviation does an excellent job. The ground suppression does an excellent job. They just do an excellent job in 12 locations. And advocates would like to see that list because contractors do make themselves available statewide almost exclusively, and then sometimes additional states. For this conversation, really all we're asking for is one list easily available without records request or, you know, going through the process of getting hold of 12 lists to make sure that contractor is on there. So it's really just a transparency of the 12 nicely run districts in one area.
Right. That's my perspective. But with the proviso that ODF need not
no change
choose from that list.
No. It's an information feedback loop from the perspectives of the advocates only.
Well, it sounds to me that ODF really could be second in line as to these different districts, such as the Douglas or Coos Forest Protection Association. They're the first ones on the ground. They're working and getting information to the state as to what services they might need to be calling in. I mean, if they have everything, if the private landowner and the association can deal with it, we're not looking at bringing anyone else in, because if we, as Senator Berkshire says, if you can get on a quick, you can maybe keep it down less than 10 acres, where all you see on the night in the news, there's this little fire that got put out and there's no big deal. But it seems to me that the department would already be asking each of the 12 for their list. And if we already are getting their list, it just seems very, very simple to just take that and plug it in somewhere, and then we're done. And I don't know if we need to put another statute in the books.
If there's a workaround without a statute, we'd be very supportive of that. I mean, that's really, you described exactly what we're after.
Yeah. Well, we'll look at that.
Senator Perzanski, yeah. Chair Dembrough, and the department would be in that same position.
Okay. Great. We'll see what we can do.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you both very much. Was there anyone else who wanted to speak to this bill? Seeing none, I'll close our public hearing on House Bill 3006. And since it appears that Representative Helms' committee has expelled him, we will bring him up and open, what is this? House Bill 2883. Oops, sorry. So, Beth, could you tell us what this is?
Mr. Chair, members, House Bill 2883 would authorize a court to order the Oregon Fish and Wildlife Commission to revoke licenses, tags, and permits issued to a state-registered outfitter or guide who's convicted of a violation of wildlife laws that involves the taking or killing of wildlife with a culpable mental state. The measure would also increase the length of time that the Marine Board may suspend an outfitter and guide registration from 24 to 60 months for reasons outlined in the bill.
Representative.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Ken Helm, House District 34. Thanks for hearing this bill today. The bill comes to you from the floor of the House, where it passed unanimously and is also endorsed by our very own Sportsman's Caucus. So I'm proud to have that support behind the bill. The genesis of this bill was me sitting in my parents' living room in Bend last summer and reading an article about a guide who had helped poached a prized mule deer buck, put it in a freezer to stay until the following year where he could pull a tag to make that deer legal. And he had been convicted by circuit court and had received the typical fines, which is good. But then I found out that he wasn't going to lose his guide's license, and he could reapply with the Marine Board as soon as 2 years later. As part of the same article, I believe, another poaching story was of a person who held themselves out to be an outfitter and guide and then helped clients poach a large number of mule deer, again in the Central Oregon area. It seemed to me that the penalties for those individuals were not dire enough. So I worked with numerous groups, including the Oregon Hunters Association and members of the conservation community, to come up with this bill. The bill takes the implications of the bill occur after a court has already found that an individual has violated the wildlife laws. So a guide or outfitter would have already been required to be found to have violated those laws. Then this bill permits the judge in those instances, if the judge determines that the case is egregious enough, to pull all of those that guides, permits, and licenses, including their personal hunting and fishing licenses, for life, if it's that bad. Probably we're not going to run into that very often. But another circumstance in which I worked with the Marine Board on was how they have to process or react to these bad actors in the relicensing, the reauthorization of those guides and outfitter licenses. And again, that two-year period for reapplying after you've been found to have violated the wildlife laws seemed to them to be too short. And at their suggestion, we increased that period to 5 years. And here was their reasoning. They said, look, we can pull the outfitter's permit, but then we have to relook at it every 2 years. Give us 5 years, and we'll have a lot more time to work with. And if somebody has to wait 5 years to regain their license after having lost it to be an outfitter or a guide, they're not going to be able to weather that economically, they'll find something else to do. And so this bill also gives the Marine Board that authority. So otherwise, this is a very, very simple bill. It only applies to violations of the wildlife laws where the individual was found to have a culpable mental state. So there are numerous examples, and we probably, as people that hunt or fish, may have gotten close to a violation ourselves. Maybe we were accidentally retaining a kind of fish that was out of season. Or there are multiple examples of hunters who have believed that they were shooting at one deer and there was another deer behind. Or they'd misidentified. Those are violations, yes, but they do not contain the culpable mental state. And without the culpable mental state, all those types of violations are off the board here. It is only where culpable mental state is found of a guide or an outfitter in a court of law that this bill will come into play. I think you'll find in subsequent testimony today that our true sportsmen of the state embrace this bill because we want our guiding industry to be squeaky clean. We're famous for having great opportunities for fishing and hunting in this state, and so for those folks that are coming in from elsewhere in the country to enjoy that, we need to give them the confidence that they're dealing with somebody that's reputable and will be holding our own wildlife laws in the highest regard. Thank you for hearing the bill, and I'm happy to answer questions.
Thanks very much, Representative. Yes, Senator Roble.
So my only question is, say I got a game violation in the last 3 years, and I now apply for a license. Does this go retroactively back and say, nope, come back in 2 years, as opposed to they can get their license now because they weren't a guide when they committed the crime, and now they want to become a guide? Is there any look back with respect to people who may have already been doing this kind of having this kind of behavior in the past for getting a license?
Mr. Chair and Senator Roveland, that's a great question. And my answer is I think the existing statute already takes care of that. This bill wouldn't necessarily address that. When we amended portions of the Marine Board's authority, there's a long list of actions, convictions for various different crimes that they already can consider when they're reissuing or issuing for the first time a guide or outfitter's license. So they would be able to, is my understanding, they can take that into account, but it's part of existing law.
Senator Bridger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe not a lot about the bill, but I'm confused. So you got the State Marine Board, and we got fishing guides, and we got big game guides. Does the State Marine Board have jurisdiction over the big game guides too?
They of issuing them their outfitters and guides license, yes,
they
Senator.
Do. Okay, I didn't know that.
Interesting. Yeah. Okay. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Okay. Let's hear from Tom Wolf and Joe Roeder. And we'll wrap this one up.
Chair Dembro, committee members, for the record, my name is Tom Wolf with Trout Unlimited, and apparently one of the outstanding true sportsmen here in the state of Oregon. So I appreciate that. It's going to go in my bio. So. But I'm here to support, Trout Unlimited is here to support HB 2883A. I was involved with a bill that was passed in 2013 that did a lot to strengthen the requirements for being a guide, because guides are the ambassadors to hunting and fishing in Oregon. A lot of people, when they come in to say, when I go to a place that I don't know how to where to go hunting and fishing. I hire a guide, and they're the people that show me where to go. And a lot of times with Oregon, whether it's hunting or fishing, they're the people that show, and they have a, I believe they should have a high standard for the people that they guide, because they're representing the state of Oregon. They're representing all of us. And I'm appalled that this one example that Representative Helm shared did what he did, because he ruined himself as an ambassador for the state. So I think this current bill in its form, and we've worked, I've been involved in the work group on this and worked a lot with the Marine Board and ODFW on making this and strengthening the weak parts of that. And I believe what we currently have in the the final version that passed out of the House is a good bill that deals with problem people that intentionally try to violate our fish and wildlife laws that are guides, but give a certain amount of leeway to people that might make a mistake, because we all possibly could make a mistake in breaking violations. Well, almost everybody else but a true sportsman like me can make that mistake. But my organization supports this bill. I think it's a good bill, and great kudos to Representative Helm for bringing this forward. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Joe.
Senator Dembro, members of the committee, my name's Joe Rolater. I live near Walport, Oregon. I've been involved in river guiding and the ocean chartering industry for not 35 years. I've served on several different boards and commissions. By the way, in 79 or 80, the Oregon Guides and Packers, I was on their board as a charter representative. We went to the Marine Board and asked the Marine Board to register us and to set ethical standards for us. So over that whole time that I've been involved in guiding, I've always tried to improve the professionalism of the guiding industry in Oregon. I think it's good for Oregon. I think it's good for the fish and wildlife to have a professional guiding industry. Intentional violation of fish and game laws is just not acceptable to me in a professional guide. And I support House Bill 2883A. I'm sorry, I forgot the number. So thank you very much.
Great, thank you. Colleagues, any questions of these two illustrious gentlemen?
Sportsmen.
I'd almost say honored.
Sportsmen, fishermen.
Okay, thank you both very much.
Okay. And I do consider myself a good sportsman.
He is.
Not often.
Tom is too.
He's occasionally not a very good sport when I miss something.
Tom's a good sport as well. That's all right. So with that, I'm going to close our public hearing on House Bill 2883. And those of you who've been waiting patiently for us to get back to 2711, I'm going to ask for your patience just for a moment longer, because I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3025. We have one person to speak to it. Elizabeth Remley, come up. Beth, tell us what this does.
Mr. Chair, members, House Bill 3025 would exclude certain battery charger systems from the definition of battery charger system for the purposes of the energy efficiency standards.
Okay, Beth, so why do we want to water down our standards?
Well, Chair Dembro and members of the committee, Elizabeth Remley here today on behalf of the Consumer Technology Association, which is a national trade association representing consumer technology. We are not watering down our standards, Senator, and you know better than that. So we mirror our energy efficiency standards for consumer electronics are mirrored to California standards, and I believe Washington also mirrors California standards. And as California moves, we try to do the same thing, usually within rule, but not always. What happened when California originally wrote their bill was that they accidentally included these little battery chargers. And what they are there's a little battery, especially in big server rooms, that protects the memory if there's a power surge. and the battery charger has to charge the little battery. It's such a small component of such of these really large sort of enterprise type boxes that it's impossible to measure its energy efficiency on its own or its energy output on its own. And so the implementing this particular piece of the consumer technology energy efficiency standards in all three states has been delayed and delayed and delayed. The Department of Energy went through, after California finally took it out of theirs, the Department of Energy went through an update in rule to match the changes that California had made and figured out they couldn't do this change in rule, but they didn't figure that out until after their deadline for submitting bills to the governor. So we've got this little bill, and all it does is mirror California and take our mistake out of our law because they made a mistake. So that's why we should not water down our energy efficiency standards and instead fix the technical mistake.
I will accept that frame of that. Yes, Senator Richard.
Observation. Now you know why we should never mirror what California's doing.
Senator Bartsugar, if you take a look on OLIS at my client's testimony, you will find that they may agree with you quite a bit, actually.
Yeah. Although the same can apply with respect to federal regulation as well. It has been known to happen. But yes, Senator Robler.
So once we take this out, does that mean that the current battery charger system, that is this little one, will no longer be a battery charging system?
No, Senator. What it means is that we are not measuring its energy efficiency against the requirements for that product that we have in the state. So the larger product that it's within will still have energy efficiency standards that they must meet. But there's no way to measure the energy efficiency standard for this little tiny battery charger, and so the folks who are selling those products would actually have to stop selling them in Oregon. Department of Energy's never implemented this piece of the puzzle because they can't.
Okay.
So.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Any other questions? Anybody else here who wants to speak to this bill? Okay, then that's that.
Thank you.
Colleagues, I'm going to close our public hearing on House Bill 3025. And I'm going to bring us back to House Bill 2711A. And Ian, you want to come up?
I appreciate that.
Good afternoon, Chair Denbrough, members of the committee. My name is Ian Maiden. I'm the Chief Scientist and Deputy Director for the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries, and I manage the Mineral Land Reclamation and Regulation Program, which oversees oil and gas drilling in the state.
Great. So, Ian, do you want to talk to us a little bit about to what extent the state does have rules regarding fracturing both conventional and unconventional? You know, the vertical and that which
certainly
goes on.
So it's important to understand that the kinds of activities that are now referred to as hydraulic fracturing are part of a suite of well stimulation practices that have been being carried out for decades. And it has only been in the last couple of decades that this particular incarnation of stimulation techniques, which is a combination of long horizontal bores to access large amounts of rock, and then the hydraulic fracturing to open up fracture networks in that rock and free gas from otherwise impermeable rock, has become really, the technology has allowed that to become very widespread. As a result, our rules talk about or give us the authority to regulate and mechanisms to regulate stimulation processes in wells in general and to regulate whether holes are drilled vertically or are deviated and allowed to go horizontally. But they don't specifically reference the more common practice now of hydraulic fracturing for that specific purpose on that specific scale. So we feel that if somebody came to us and was wanting to drill one of these holes, that we could craft a regulatory response that would be adequate with our existing regulatory framework and statutory framework. But you can't go into our rules and find the section on hydraulic fracturing and specific steps that have to be taken with respect to that. It tends to be more general that you can't design a well that is going to allow material fluids to move from one horizon, geologic horizon, into another. You have to construct the well bore in such a way that it cannot communicate with the aquifers that it passes through. These are more sort of fundamental safeguards that aren't specifically related to hydraulic fracturing.
Mm-hmm. And so what would, you know, if let's say, you know, a firm were to come to you and say, you know, we're thinking of doing, you know, an unconventional hydraulic fracturing operation somewhere in the district where Senator Roepland lives, for example, what would be the next steps?
Well, in that particular case, in Coos Bay with the coal bed methane, we did have a response with the existing regulatory scheme. We worked with our sister agencies. DEQ has the primary authority for the actual injection of material and the control of the chemicals and other materials that are being injected, and set up a monitoring program to go along with that. So we put together a response in that particular case. It was a relatively small number of wells. And it was different from most of the hydraulic fracturing that is in the news because it was being done with nitrogen gas and silica sand, both of which are chemically inert materials. And so we set up a groundwater monitoring program to make sure that nothing got into the groundwater, but frankly, it's kind of hard to detect nitrogen in groundwater that's come from the atmosphere as opposed to something you've injected. But it was done in an abundance of caution. There are also other drilling fluids that are associated just with normal drilling operations that could have been detected had they migrated out of the formation and into the groundwater. So if the scale was small enough and the processes were simple enough, I don't see any reason why we couldn't repeat that performance. If it's in different rocks with different characteristics and different chemicals that are required and a larger scale process, we would probably feel more comfortable if we'd had the opportunity to upgrade our rules to specifically address these factors.
And just following up on that, Representative Helm mentioned that 2 years ago there was discussion of of directing the agency to develop rules, but it turned out to be too expensive. What kind of dollars are we talking about here?
So I went and looked up our fiscal from that year, and frankly, I can't remember whether the number was $68,000, $78,000, or $88,000, but it was in that range, less than $100,000 for our part of the rule writing. I can't speak for DEQ. Because that's a big portion of that. Everything related to the chemicals and the reporting of the material and the handling, all that kind of stuff is on the DEQ side.
Okay. Yes, Senator Roepland.
So we have had a lot of hydraulic and other kinds of fracturing done around the country over the last 10 years. And places like Pennsylvania have written new rules because they've found what worked and what didn't work, sadly. Have we had any opportunity to look at the geology of our state looking at what's happening in other places to see if we can learn from the rules they've already put in place that would make it safer for us to do the drilling as opposed to and have that all set up instead of saying we aren't going to do it, start looking about if we were to do it, what kinds of things will safeguard it? Because I appreciated the process that went into Coos County. You know, you had scientists who were checking all the water before they did anything and checking it afterwards, and all the water and stuff that came out of the wellhead all got put in a tank and taken over to the waste system in our system. It was really done cautiously, I don't know if that was because we had a company that was willing to work with all of you, but it seemed to go really well with regard to what the state learned about what we had underneath us in our geology and with respect to protecting the environment, because I didn't. And they did follow-up studies on those rivers for a while, too, to make sure that there was nothing leaking out. And it appears that it didn't change any of those things. So I was, and a whole lot of PR people were very pleased with the actions that were taken and the rules that were put in place over time. Could, because there's been so much activity, could, given the money that we were just talking about, $70,000, do you have the authority now, if given the resources, to develop rules based on what our geology is and the knowledge you've already, they've learned around the country with respect to what's the safe way to do this?
Okay, so two parts to that question.
Yep.
I believe we have the statutory authority to do that. We have very broad statutory authority to write rules to prevent contamination and breaches of wells and the whole variety of activities. In terms of having the financial capacity to go out and spend that $70,000 or $80,000
right.
now on rule writing, the answer is no. And
right.
and the issue here is that this program is entirely fee supported, and we get a very small portion of our fees from oil and gas drilling, which
right.
is largely ongoing activities up at the Miss gas field, which is not, you know, they're
yep.
doing maintenance essentially drilling up there. And so that program barely generates enough revenue to cover the costs associated with regulating that small amount of activity. And this $70,000 or $80,000 would basically have to be borne by the aggregate industry, which pays for the remainder of our operating expenses. And so without seeing any of this drilling on the horizon, we would not undertake that kind of expenditure. Before someone comes in to develop a new oil and gas field in Oregon, they're going to have to do years worth of exploration, seismic exploration first, and then drilling exploration. So we're not going to get caught flat-footed with somebody coming in with a permit next month to go and do fracking in a field that we've never had any experience with before. We'll see them coming for years, and perhaps then, you know, be in a position to write those rules. I would add that we're talking about or we're planning on a major rule rewrite for our entire package starting later this year. So the door would be open, but again, the funding for that part is not available now.
Okay.
Ian, could the people who are doing the exploration, could they help pay for that rulemaking? I mean, what kind of fees are we putting on them if they apply for a...
Inadequate currently. We have needed a fee adjustment for oil and gas drilling for some time. Certainly we would generate some additional revenue with new exploration, but the exploration permit fees are relatively minor.
And the cost, well, I mean, once you're moving from exploration itself is a fairly expensive process, isn't it? I mean, it's going to require a major investment.
Oh, that's correct. If somebody's coming in to do 3D seismic to look for a new play, they're spending tens of millions of dollars just to open the door. And then, you know, test wells are in that same range. But again, because our fees haven't been updated in some time, you know, we probably lose money on most of the wells that get permitted in the state.
Well, maybe we should look at that. I mean, it seems that that's something that the companies involved should be bearing much of the responsibility for.
Certainly.
As opposed to the citizens. Yes, Senator Brzezinski.
So we have this Dugami fact sheet on hydraulic fracturing in Oregon. Where did that come from?
That fact sheet was put together by Dugami working in concert with DEQ, I believe.
Water resources. In fact, they're in here too.
Excuse me?
Water resources,
yeah. It was either done in 2015 for the earlier version of Senator Helms' bill, or it may actually have predated that. That would have been before my time.
Yeah, it says April 2015, but this was something that was, let's say, created based on some other prior legislation that we were looking at.
That's correct.
And is this the $60,000 to $80,000 that we spent to put this together? I'm just, because I thought there was an expenditure I heard.
No, that's what we would have had to spend to do the rulemaking, or just for Dugami's.
That's correct. That was just the Dugami side of the fiscal. And I'm sorry, I can't remember the number of that bill, but I can certainly look it up and
see. No, that's fine.
Well, thank you very much, Ian. Yeah. Okay, let's hear from some other people. We'll start with Angela Crowley Cook, Paige Spence, and Rhett Lawrence.
Chair Dembro, members of the committee, Angela Crowley Cook, Oregon Environmental Council. OEC supports House Bill 2711A to impose a moratorium on hydraulic fracturing in order to safeguard our water resources here in Oregon. Fracking takes an enormous amount of water, on average uses over 2 million gallons of water per well for oil, and then over 4 million gallons of water for natural gas extraction. Most of the water used for fracking is too tainted for other productive uses. Up to 600 chemicals may be used in fracking operations, including known carcinogens, toxics such as formaldehyde, lead, and mercury. In total, around 40,000 gallons of chemicals are used for fracturing. And so there are concerns with these chemicals used for fracking, and then the injected wastewater that can migrate and contaminate drinking water sources. According to ProPublica, there have been over 1,000 documented cases by courts, as well as state and local governments, of contamination next to areas of gas drilling. And so in Oregon, we know that this year aside, we've been having more and more water scarcity and drought issues. And so according to the recent audit of the Water Resources Department, by 2050, Oregon could be faced with a need for an additional 424 billion gallons of water per year to meet our current irrigation, municipal, and industrial demand for water. So even though Oregon, in half the state, is a rainy place, we're still worried about water quantity, especially because over 70% of Oregon residents get their drinking water from groundwater. So because of these issues about concern for water contamination, we urge your support of this bill. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Dembro and committee members. For the record, Paige Spence here on behalf of the Oregon League of Conservation Voters in support of House Bill 2711. The bill as amended would put in place a 10-year moratorium on the hydraulic fracturing or fracking of oil and gas wells that could be explored for development here in Oregon. As has been noted today, this bill is a 10-year moratorium. It does not preclude fracking forever. Instead, it provides the legislature and the state agencies with time to determine how to proceed on the issue. OLCV believes that the bill is a reasonable and forward-thinking measure that will allow the state and our communities sufficient time to develop a regulatory framework for fracking if it were to be considered here in Oregon, that hopefully would prevent impacts on human health and safety and the environment. As Angela mentioned, fracking sends millions of gallons of chemical-laden pressurized fluid into each well, into deep layers of rock that create these fractures of the trapped oil and gas to escape. Fracking's also created its share of unwanted byproduct. Some 36,000 oil and gas wastewater injection wells, disposal sites for this fluid that seeps to the surface after a well is fracked, lie sunk across the entire country, except here in Oregon. Fracking wastewater is a toxic brew containing some of the carcinogenic inflammable chemicals left over from the fracking process, as well as heavy metals and radioactive materials like radon and radium that seep out of the deep rock layers. Between 2005 and 2014, America pumped approximately 189 billion gallons of fracking wastewater down injection wells, which is the equivalent of letting the full force of Niagara Falls gush directly onto the earth for 14 and a half days. In the decade or so since the fracking boom began nationally, we have seen drilling operations contaminate drinking water, pollute air, and threaten the health of nearby residents, including getting into residential water supplies. Nationally, fracking has generated so many gallons of toxic wastewater and over 100 million metric tons of global warming pollution since 2005, not to mention the nearly incalculable land degradation. We're grateful to Rep. Helm for bringing this bill forward and help Oregon get in front of this issue. Thank you.
Chair Dembro, members of the committee, my name is Rhett Lawrence. I'm the conservation director for the Oregon chapter of the Sierra Club.
In the interest of time, I'll keep it brief. I have submitted written testimony. Yeah, I think you've heard a lot already about the impacts of fracking around the country, so I won't belabor that point. But Sierra Club certainly would be concerned if those sorts of operations, fracking operations, were coming to Oregon. As you also have heard, we don't have any right now, so we would like to keep it that way. I also wanted to make another point that hadn't been made yet in earlier testimony, was that this fracking ban, fracking moratorium, would not apply to the geothermal type of activities that are being done out like near the Newberry volcano in central Oregon. So, again, I think that the Sierra Club ultimately, is not convinced, doesn't believe there's a safe or, environmentally responsible way to frack. And so, we believe a moratorium is appropriate while we look at what's been done around the country to properly regulate fracking. As has been mentioned, Pennsylvania is one of the other states that they've got hundreds of pages of regulation on this issue, and I think my Sierra Club colleagues in Pennsylvania would tell you that that's not been adequate to prevent the problems there. So you can regulate it all you want. I think it doesn't rule out all the degradations that you've heard about in prior testimony. So we believe a moratorium is entirely appropriate and would certainly encourage your support for this bill. Thank you.
Thanks, Rhett. Colleagues, any questions? Okay, thank you. Thank you very much. Okay, let's have the two Thomases, Wolf and Mosher, please.
Chair Denbrough, committee members, for record, my name again is Tom Wolf with the Oregon Council of Trout Unlimited, here representing the 3,200 members of Trout Unlimited here in the state and the 150,000 across the nation. Because Trout Unlimited is a national group, the largest cold water conservation group in the United States, of course, we've worked with hydraulic fracturing has been a problem that we've been working on. In fact, if I remember right, and don't hold me to this, we were involved in a lot of what happened in Pennsylvania, because Trout Unlimited has close to 15,000 members in the state of Pennsylvania, and it's a very important state in the history of our organization. So hydraulic fracturing can lead to a lot of problems and some concerns in trout and salmon habitat, because it can cause all sorts of damage to the aquifer that can have impacts on the stream and on the fish themselves. So Trout Unlimited supports HB 2711-A. We believe that a 10-year moratorium would give us a chance to make some studies to get a better handle of this. And it doesn't ban hydraulic fracturing forever. It can lead to some safe process that will protect our trout and salmon streams here in Oregon, because, and I'm speaking as a fish guy, we are a incredibly gifted state when it comes to trout and salmon streams. We have, no offense to Montana and other streams, we have the finest trout and salmon fishing streams here in the United States. And anything that could have a negative impact on those wonderful and precious fisheries that produce millions of dollars and billions of dollars for the economy here in Oregon need to be looked at carefully. So we support this bill. We think it's a good bill, and thank you for this chance to testify.
Thanks.
Chair Denbrough, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Thomas Mosher. I'm here representing Central Oregon Land Watch, and we support HB 2711-A. First, we want to thank Representatives Helm and Lively for their work on this. The proposed moratorium is an important protection for our people and our waterways. Taking time to weigh the concerns, collect data, develop regulations, and potentially develop better, safer methods only makes sense. The safety of our people, our water, and land is too important to risk. Pushing the pause button on hydraulic fracking while we develop the important regulations and allow for important research into the potentially disastrous risks that come from this process is the least we can do. We encourage your support.
Thank you. Senator Robles.
Thank you. I guess my question is this. If we put a moratorium, to me, that just means we aren't going to do any of the things you just said we had time to do. Because if we don't have to, where's the money going to come from? It's not going to come from fees, because we've already been told that fees come from the people who do the exploration. And the legislature has not in the past, nor does it seem this session, because of our money problems, going to put money out to go and search and do the regulations that need to be done when there isn't a problem for having any of it coming, because we have a moratorium. So I don't know how we get to the point, because I would really like to get to the point where we study, make sure that we do the things that prepare us if this were ever to come, so that we could do it as safely as we can. So how does the moratorium help us with that, other than postpone the time in which we're going to be faced with having to do something?
Oh, we're in that process where we're looking at each other for answers. Now we know we're in trouble. Chair Dembrough, Senator Roblin, that's a great question, and I wish I had a great answer for you. But a moratorium, to me, gives us answers to look a time to look at the problems, and without throwing my conservation community under the bus here. To be honest, and I don't know how to deal with it. Maybe we need to look at answering some of the questions you just had, because I don't have the answers for that, and I'd be dishonest if I tried to lie to you, because after all, I am a great sportsman, but not necessarily the absolute knowledge on this issue, but. You know, obviously, hydraulic fracturing is something that's going to be around, and maybe I'm not suggesting that we deviate from this bill, but we do need to answer some of those questions that you just had.
I agree. We have a lot of questions. But.
Yeah. Thomas, you want to take a stab at it?
Sure. Chair Dembrough, Senator Roblin. I'm not a great sportsman, but I did come from Pennsylvania.
That's good.
And one of the things that I'll say is just has been brought up quite a lot. Just because we create a moratorium or we impose a moratorium doesn't mean everyone else will too. And this might be a situation where we will learn from the mistakes of others, unfortunately, and or just be able to compile the data that's already been there. I think that the interest in doing that research and in looking into how those regulations should be seems to already exist just from what we've heard. And the hope would be that the people push to get something done.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay, thank you both. All right, our last panel, Julia DeGraw and Claudia Keith, please.
For the record, I am Julia DeGraw. I'm the Northwest organizer with Food and Water Watch. And we represent around 30,000 supporters in the state of Oregon. And there's a lot that I was going to say that's already been said about the impacts of hydraulic fracturing across the country. I think something that people have failed to mention that is outlined in my comments that are submitted in writing, and I'm not going to read all of them right now, but there's also public health issues related to the pollution from fracking. And we're talking about doing this in one of the more populated parts of the state, and I think there's been a lot of really great research coming out recently in the 2015-2016 that really documents increased health hazards and air quality in the state of Oregon, as we well know, is already a major issue, and we're trying to address that, you know, diesel contamination and all sorts of other problems with a task force right now. And I think that needs to be part of the conversation when we're talking about fracking, as we're talking about really severe air quality issues that contribute to climate change. And I think that's another thing that I'm surprised there's a lack of of really talking about the fact that climate change is a very real and pressing issue, and that fracking, regardless of how safe you make it through regulation, is going to be a major contributor to greenhouse gas pollution. And we really, as a state, need to be moving toward renewables if we're going to be serious about avoiding the worst parts of climate change and frankly, runaway climate change. So Food and Water Watch supports this bill, HB 2711A, because we see it as a big step in the right direction. We have states across the country that are much more threatened by fracking that are passing bans. Maryland just passed a fracking ban. The governor of Maryland, who is a Republican, actually said on the record that you're either for fracking or you're against it. He really seemed to have gotten the message from a lot of serious organizing in that state, from people who are really genuinely afraid of what would happen on the ground if fracking came to their state. And I think that if we took this issue as seriously as those in Maryland and other states in the East Coast took it, we wouldn't hesitate so hard to pass something as simple as a fracking moratorium. So I just really want to put that out there, that a fracking moratorium is a huge step in the right direction, and we really should be setting ourselves up to become more energy, moving toward renewable energy policies and away from these fossil fuel options, because they're just not going to be good for our state ultimately moving forward, especially given the harsh realities of climate change, which we should not be ignoring. But that said, we support your support on HB 2711A. Thank you.
Thanks, Julia.
Claudia. Chair Denbrough and committee members, I'm Claudia Keith, speaking for the League of Women Voters, testifying in favor of House Bill 2711, which imposes a moratorium on use of hydraulic fracturing, known as fracking. Please refer to my written testimony. Our testimony in support of House Bill 2711 is consistent with the League's national positions to preserve the physical, chemical, and biological integrity of the ecosystem, with a focus on demanding pollution prevention and ensuring justice and public safety for all people. Thank you. Our recommendation is in consideration and following facts detailed in my written testimony. Please refer to the major New York State fracking environmental study completed that supports moratorium. That very comprehensive study addresses serious issues in these categories: drinking water, seismic activity, climate change, soil contamination, and community and health complaints. On the topic of climate change, I'd like to remind the committee that League of Women Voters Oregon clearly supports and prioritizes net zero greenhouse gas emissions before 2050 by implementing 8% annual greenhouse gas emission reduction starting now. Additionally, California and several other states have had problematic underground aquifer contamination issues caused by fracking-related waste materials illegally dumped into old wells. In addition, California and other western states affected by variable drought conditions are very aware of the excessive volume of valuable agriculture and/or drinking water used in fossil fuel fracking processes. For these and other reasons, we support House Bill 2711A. Thank you for inviting us to testify at this public hearing. Thank you.
Thank you, Claudia. Colleagues, yes, Senator Birchmer.
Just kind of a, not about the issue, but is Food and Water Watch, are they part of Water Watch?
No, we're definitely separate organizations, yeah. We're a national organization with satellite offices throughout the country, with an office for the Northwest based here in Portland, or not here in Portland, in Portland, Oregon.
Thank you.
Yeah. Food and Water Watch focuses a lot on water quality, and Water Watch, certainly quality, but also a lot of quantity issues.
Yeah, and Food and Water Watch really focuses on privatization issues and water policy as well. It's something that is
yeah,
our
I just
core issues.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, thank you both very much for.
Thank you.
So, colleagues, I'm going to be consulting with you all and the sponsors and other interested people about how we can, how to proceed and maybe get answers, the answers to the questions that Senator Roblin posed in a way that that would be satisfactory. So with that, I'm going to close our public hearing on House Bill 2711A. Two of the bills that we heard today, I'm scheduling for a work session for Wednesday, so we need to carry them over. That's 2883 and 3025.
Right, 2883 and which one?
And 3025.
All right, those being carried over to when?
To Wednesday.
For work sessions.
For work sessions, yeah. And the others will probably post for next week or we'll talk about.
But you need to...
You need to carry them over.
You need to do something. Yeah.
There's time. There's regular notice time. So since they've been on an agenda for a possible work session, we're
okay. Good. Yeah. I just want to make sure we don't.
I agree. Yeah. It has happened earlier.
I double checked.
Yeah, it has.
Okay, so did I close that work session, that public hearing? Let me close the public hearing on House Bill 2711A. And colleagues, we're adjourned until Wednesday.
Thank you very much.
Adjourned until Wednesday.
Thank you very much.